I just want to say a few things about catastrophism. From my point of view, I wrote the introduction to the PM Press book, and I have a quick and superficial understanding of the topic that I'll share with you. I want to assure you that none of us on this panel are Pollyannas, that we are very skeptical of the political utility of the catastrophist narrative. Here we are, we still haven't recovered from the worst financial and economic crisis of the last 80 years. Climate change is upon us, not even a future threat anymore. Yet it's really hard to really discern any political enlightenment coming from these catastrophes or imminent catastrophes. Crisis really does not really inspire people. It does not inspire them to challenge the existing order. It more typically paralyzes them. It doesn't necessarily bring out the best in us. It may bring out competitiveness and individualism and a desire for self-preservation rather than a rational cooperation or utopic union to fight for better days. The political consequences of the economic crisis have not been good for our side. There was Occupy, but that largely fizzled out, though I am open to argument to the contrary. We saw some heroic protests, especially in Greece, but there's been surprisingly little political resistance to the Frankfurt-Brussels austerity program. In Italy, a major beneficiary of their economic crisis is a comedian with no measurable politics. We've seen the revival of a pre-1930s orthodox economic thinking throughout almost every important policymaking position in the world. We have been subject to the strange and surreal experience of watching the IMF, of all institutions, urging governments to be less austere than they want to be. It's like Andrew Mellon's old recipe for the after the Great Crash in 1929, liquidate, 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 has become virtual elite consensus. There are some signs of an elite rethink of the austerity agenda, but it doesn't seem to be much of a reaction to actual popular resistance that's forcing it. Hard times are not really good for radical activity. They make people scared and defensive and more in the mood for a return to the status quo ante than for any kind of risky transformation. The upsurge of the 1960s came late in the post-war boom, and even the celebrated radical actions of the 1930s in the U.S. Came later in the decade. The Flint strikes were 1936-37 at the peak of a strong economic recovery from the depths of 1932-33. GDP and employment both rose about 25% or 30% from their lows, one of the great booms in modern American history, in fact. And so there's something about the possibility of better times that make people want more. It was not, we didn't see that kind of agitation in 1932 or 33. And of course, the European 1930s, well, we don't, I don't want to invoke Godwin's law this early in the proceedings, but we all know what happened in Europe in the 1930s. On the climate issue, the climate is a mess and it's only getting worse, but I don't think jumping up and down and saying we're doomed is a very effective political strategy. In fact, it's disarming. Parson Malthus is never far from the surface in a lot of environmental thought, and I think as Engels was right to call that a system of despair. Evoking the imminence of social collapse won't prompt a rethink. There's a line from the poet A.R. Ammons that I like very much. When one knows he's going out, when can we blame him for shoving the voltage up? The sense that our days are numbered may only make people grab all the gusto they can get before it's all over, rather than trying to prolong things. And I think embracing neo-primitivism as an aspiration in the style of some extremely radical environmentalists will attract you a following that could be counted in the hundreds. Theories of inevitable collapse have infected the Marxist left for much of its history. Now some of that spirit has been taken up by many Reds and radical Greens around climate. But the economic crisis has always refused to stay terminal. The climate crisis is a different story. It's for real. But invoking disaster, although as tempting as that may seem, doesn't really seem to work very well to wake people up. The non-response to Hurricane Sandy, right where we sit, this neighborhood was rather damaged by Hurricane Sandy, but it had apparently no lasting political effects either, even though that's a foretaste of many more things to come. So what we desperately need to do is revive or summon or invoke or create some sort of revolutionary optimism. I know it's really hard to call that into existence just by saying so, but for that we can accept no substitutes. So let me pass things along to Eddie Yoon.
Thanks, Doug. Thank you. I'm going to use this.
Let me just get you here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, great. Okay. Yeah, so, I guess three of the authors of the book are here. David McNally was here last night. He had to go off to, I guess, Slovenia. And Sasha Lilly, who wrote the chapter on the catastrophism of the left, various versions, is back in Oakland. She just had twins. So we're going to carry the torch of this slim volume, which is slim because we don't actually offer a lot of prescriptions. We figure that's a bigger project for conferences like this and for all of us together. We really came together... along a kind of question of, well, we're living in the zeitgeist of zombies, right, and of catastrophe. What's going on with this? How is it that there are so many different kinds of end-of-the-world scenarios on offer, and how can we make a taxonomy of them? How can we sort of parse them? How can we determine, most importantly, the political efficacy of them for various political tendencies that are offering them? We didn't specifically talk so much about liberal catastrophism of the kind that the Democratic Party gives us every 4 years. You know, vote for us or you're going to get Sarah Palin, right? That's a certain kind of electoral project, which does work in scaring people, but I guess if that's the goal, then yeah, it works for on that level. There's, of course, neoliberal catastrophism, that is capital. I think maybe the most important version is capital basically saying there is no alternative, right? Thatcher was one of the progenitors of this project, and it continues to this day in a zombie kind of form, right? Neoliberalism goes on, even though people know it's bankrupt ideologically, but it's still presented as, well, the banks are too big to fail, so there's going to be a catastrophe unless the system continues as it is without fundamental change. And then, of course, within the popular culture, catastrophe is everywhere, to the point where I think we're, as a society, suffering a bit from catastrophe fatigue, right, on various levels. When something real happens and people just liken it to films and movies, there's a kind of pessimistic expectation around declensionist narratives, thinking things getting worse all the time. Okay, so those are some of the, and David McNally, in his chapter on zombies and the body, talks about that in this volume. But in each one of these, kinds of catastrophism has a different history. They're not all commensurable in the same way. And the chapter that I wrote on the environmental catastrophe, I think, is of course unique for the simple fact that the catastrophe is real, right? The catastrophe is unlike some of the right-wing fantasies that Jim is going to talk about in a minute. These apocryphal apocalypses, right? Lepers coming over from the border and so on. This is something that is not only is it real; it's actually worse. In all likelihood, than what we're being told, even last week, right? The scientific consensus, it's not entirely consensus, but close to it, is just getting more and more dire. So the problematic that I've faced as an environmental activist is, why is it that if you simply tell people, this is, things are really bad, ocean acidification, the possible, extermination of life in the seas, just one example. People, it's not that they don't believe it. I mean, there is some climate denialism in the U.S., especially from the highest levels in particular. But really, a more common response is people shutting down. People are saying, that's overwhelming, I can't deal with this. And there have been a couple of studies, sociological studies, which basically put the question to college students, and it demonstrated the same effect, the headline being, the more people know, the less they care, right? So it's not having this desired effect, sort of the Paul Revere, charging through the village, wake up, the scales must fall off the eyes, don't you realize we've been, this is happening. So I had sort of two responses to that initially. One is, well, you look at the study, say, and you look at not just the study, but what most environmentalists and scientists are presenting, the problem is we're not offering something as a viable alternative. So in the case of these studies, the option is, okay, if you knew more about what's going on, climate change, would you basically consume more virtuously, right? That's usually what's offered. I had a plastic water bottle earlier, and I felt guilty about that. I recycled it, but still, what kinds of clothes are you wearing? What kinds of food are you eating? How high in the food chain are you eating? Are you recycling? These are the kinds of things that people are enjoying to think about as a solution. And to their credit, I think many Americans, many people in the rich world, see that this is grossly inadequate. in the same way that many people don't vote, right? It's the glass half full and the glass half empty. That it was, on some level, people were saying, this is a solution that's not sufficient. Okay, well, in that case, then we have to ask, well, what would it be? How could this be presented, you know, as part of a movement that people can join that's not simply asking for more austerity, because austerity, after all, is the discourse of capitalism right now. So it's not unsurprising, but it's also probably not helpful politically that environmentalists have been preaching a different version of austerity themselves for a long time. It's alarmingly congruent with the austerity of capital. And this, I think, gets to the heart of the problem, right? This is the second, observation that I came up with around this, is that the problem is that environmentalists and scientists, again, to their credit, jump ahead to thinking about human beings as a species. Kind of a species being, if you like. A kind of a consciousness that, you know, we are all in this together. We, as Homo sapiens sapien, you know, we have a particular project that we're involved in, civilization, industrial civilization, and we have to stop doing what we're doing. We're on a spaceship Earth, you know. It's now a lifeboat, you know. And we have to basically manage the commons better. We have to stop exploiting the planet better. We have to be more sustainable, and so on and so forth. Okay, a fine sentiment, and I think it's great to jump to that moment on many levels. However, it doesn't, in fact, describe the reality of the world. Humans are not all one undifferentiated species right now. In fact, we are extremely differentiated, and anybody who's at a historical materialism conference will know that, you know, this differentiation occurs principally along class, race, geographic, gender lines, right? And I think I want to really focus on class, geographic, meaning, you know, the north-south, which is not an easy map, it's an uneven map. And of course, this is deeply racialized and it's deeply historical. But in fact, the crisis does not affect all people in the same way. And in fact, the crisis is not in the future. Right, the apocalypse is now, depending on who we are. Right, and so we can see this as it plays out in various examples. So some of the historic examples of kind of environmental catastrophism would include Y2K. Right, Y2K was an interesting case. People have already forgotten. Do people here remember Y2K? Yeah, okay. You know, this was like many kinds of catastrophist narratives. There was a kind of it crossed over left, right, center. You know, but basically the scenario was, you know, there's a computer bug that's going to bring down the computer systems of the planet, which is going to basically bring down industrial civilization, and it's time to go out, you know, into the woods, be a survivalist, or at least rusticate, grow your own food, you know, and wait it out, you know, usual right-wingers got into this stuff, and they made a lot of money selling, you know, going back to the Bircher, selling fallout shelters and, you know, guns and ammo. But also a lot of countercultural people on the West Coast in particular got really into it, and some environmentalists got into it, and they went off to various places. So again, this is an example to me of, you know, Y2K is coming. But wait a minute, in the year 2000, Y2K is already here, was already here, and still is for the majority of the world's people who've never been online or even plugged into the grid necessarily, right? So this idea that somehow, you know, this end is coming for our way of being, it's not realizing, of course, the extraordinary unevenness and the conditionality of various forms of development, right? The other problems of Y2K, of course, was that it was wrong. Maybe we'll get to that in a minute. Why was Y2K wrong? It was wrong because there was no analysis, I think, of capitalism and the relationship of technology, you know, and accumulation and crisis. But just in terms of this undifferentiated nature, right? This idea that somehow, you know, climate change is coming, it's going to affect all of humanity, and we're going to respond to it collectively. Climate change is already here. So in fact, we can now look back and say, well, it's been here for a very long time. It may have been the case since the dawn of agriculture. I think it's probable that that's affected the climate. But certainly since the 1950s, the desertification of the Sahel that is now seen as having to do with industrialism and local changes in the atmosphere. But certainly now, right, it's like you look at the various refugee problems, food scarcity, food crisis. You know, I want to paraphrase William Gibson, who wrote, you know, the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. And this is the same thing, you know, with this crisis, with our crisis. It's the climate crisis, all the environmental crises are here. And the problem is precisely that they have been, this has been the case, they have accompanied capitalism from the onset, and capital has sort of built this into it politically, right? So the global elites, governmental, corporate, NGO, are basically already planning not for mitigation but for adaptation. They're planning, this is going to happen. I mean, the Earth is being transformed. We're in the Anthropocene. The question is, how can these changes take place that do not challenge the fundamental tenets of the existing system? Principally, the inequality, principally the laws of profit, basic instrumentalization of nature, right? And that's essentially what's going forward. The problem is, of course, as Marx long ago said, the bourgeoisie tend to speak for humanity. They're speaking for all of humanity when, in fact, you know, it's a very particular interest. And as the crisis becomes pronounced, when something dramatic happens, say this superstorm here, or, you know, on whatever, every year there will be something. And so this is why this is an important subject. I feel there are many opportunities, continuous opportunities, to intervene as something happens, because somebody is going to show up, or we know who, and say, this is a problem for all of humanity. This is what we have to do. We have to unify. We have to rally around this or that project. It's a fundamentally authoritarian project, because under crisis we have to, you know, get in line here. So there's this whole climate Hobbes kind of scenario that some Swinburne and other political theorists have been talking about, right? That catastrophism, as Jim Davis will talk about later on the right, it tends to tilt right. It tends to skew people towards centralized solutions. You know, in the emergency, we need to get in line, and then also, crucially, tends to reinforce existing inequalities, particularly as they manifest on a national level. So right now you're seeing a fortification of borders, of course, either the U.S.-Mexican border, Fortress Europe, the Mediterranean, and the eastern border, wherever that shifts. These are lines which are actually lines of death. Thousands of people die every year, and Australia has, you know, a cordon as well. We expect this, all the scenarios that the Pentagon, and other governmental agencies of various nation states are planning, is precisely that we're going to expect massive amounts of climate refugees. It's going to be tied in, as Christian Parenti talks about, the Tropic of Chaos. It's going to be linked in with a failed state narrative and discourse. And again, this is already happening, right? So you're seeing, apparently, Peter Ward, the paleontologist, he opens up his book, The Flooded Earth, with a scenario only about 30 years in the future of India using nuclear weapons in Bangladesh, or against Bangladesh, as 150 million people are inundated out of an entire nation. And, you know, India is actually building a barrier, kind of a wall here. So we can see this happening south-south. We can see, you know, this is the predicted scenario, the scenario predicted by think tanks, military planners, and the scenario that's going to be done in the name of humanity, although, in fact, reinforcing national class inequalities. So that, in a nutshell, is why I think it's important that when we see undifferentiated narratives of catastrophism, when we see, you know, plutocrats invoking spaceship Earth, we give pause and say, you know, for who? Yeah, for who? So just maybe the one, yeah, so how, what kinds of solutions are on offer? Just really, really briefly, they tend to take two major forms, the technological fixes, right? And again, this is, in other words, so crisis, as is so often for capital, is an opportunity for new rounds of investment, new rounds of accumulation, new bubbles. The green bubble, it must be said, hasn't really manifested yet. A lot of people thought at Copenhagen, the climate conference a few years ago, that we're going to see massive investment in green technologies, especially alternative energies. China has really gone in on it out of necessity in part, because they're, you know, they have such a large bill of importing fossil fuels. But again, it remains to be seen whether this is really going to take off. But certainly technical fixes, this is a solution which doesn't do anything to deal with inequality or questions of justice, and often, of course, produces new kinds of problems, right? And this is a new kind of crisis, a catastrophic solution to catastrophe is a short way to put it. And certainly we're talking about geoengineering and some of these projects, right? And secondly, of course, the answer is to a crisis is more commodification, right? More in climate derivatives, right? I guess futures markets are already climate derivatives, but basically finding new ways to commodify the planet, creating a better price tag for the atmospheres, for the oceans, for biodiversity. And that we see in the project going on a lot, and we see that, for example, with RED, you know, these various projects. We're going to save the rainforest in the global south by essentially putting it on the market, creating a kind of a derivative system to save it. So again, these are solutions, I think, that in which the catastrophic narrative, unless it's challenged, unless we challenge the way in which it is undifferentiated, will lead us towards those kinds of solutions. And in conclusion, you know, we don't need to create a new movement. The movement is already there that responds to this, broadly called the climate justice movement, environmental justice movements that are quite strong in various parts of the world, South Africa, Latin America, of course, India. They don't necessarily fly the flag, the environmental or green flag all the time, but it's important to recognize these and to realize that this is, in fact, this is what's going to be necessary, to always talk about social justice simultaneous with environmental. Okay.
Thanks, Eddie.
Yeah. So my piece on the right, as Eddie has said, and maybe I'll begin with this distinction we make between catastrophe, which Eddie has outlined many of the ongoing catastrophes that do exist, and catastrophism. And catastrophism really is an attempt by us to kind of describe the way in which political rhetoric is deployed by various social movements. And as Eddie's pointed out, largely it's used or it's instrumentalized as a sort of a process of politicization. So using a very dramatic kind of narrative approach will spur people into action, and oftentimes, because it's around impending catastrophes, the real drama is provided by fear. That's kind of like what the motivational element of catastrophism is. It's like, you should be afraid. If we can make you afraid, then there'll be a political consequence of that. People will join in social movements, or people will act in particular ways. But catastrophism itself oftentimes relies on external events. Some event that's not produced politically, but that exists. And so that might be, capitalism runs up against its own internal contradictions and it will collapse. Y2K is a little bit like that. On the right, of course, they're legion. So I understand the right, for the purposes of the book, as a defensive privilege. And historically, going back, I look at it really in terms of the 20th century, though its roots are much further back in the French Revolution and the Enlightenment and counter-Enlightenment and so on. But if we think about the 20th century, the right genuinely mourns the victories of social movements, of left-wing, progressive social movements, be they feminism, be they the labor movement, civil rights, gender stuff, gay rights, gay marriage is a sort of a current. I mean, the two, if we look at the West, like Europe and the US and include Australia, and that the two great kind of common tropes of the right are Islamophobia and homophobia. These two things. So gay marriage, for example, I don't know if people were watching in the newspapers and on TV when they just passed gay marriage laws in France. The crowds in the streets are breathtaking. It's unbelievable. I think 1 million people demonstrated against this in France over the last couple of months. So this is a genuine kind of like very high level of homophobia, and it's a stick with which the right can organize and can create a genuine hysteria around attacks on our civilization, the undermining of our way of life. And Islam, it's funny in the States because there are not that many Muslims here, but Islamophobia is a huge panic on the right, particularly in Europe, and is a very, very, very successful organizing tool. You know, one of the things here recently, maybe 2 years ago, Glenn Beck, there was some case going through the Supreme Court, and Glenn Beck was agitating for months and months and months around the idea of Sharia law being implemented in the United States via Supreme Court ruling. And on the right, there's no consequences for false prophecy. You know, you can reinvent these things serially and routinely. You know, at this point, 50% of Americans are supposed to be dead through bio weapons attacks. The dollar is supposed to have fallen in value by, you probably know better than me what those predictions are, but generally it's like 50% by 2012. And then, you know, the Weimar moment, which a lot of these guys on the right keep referring back to, and they keep putting a date on, and that date gets pushed forward and forward and forward, which is often the case with apocryphal right-wing predictions. The great disappointment being probably the original. So I've broken down this kind of catastrophism on the right into two broad schools. And the first is what I've called disease catastrophism. All right, so this is the idea that social movements are the disease that is undermining and destroying our way of life, our civilization, our identity, and whatever it is. So that includes that list I already said. It's like the disease is social movements, the disease is the left. another of Glenn Beck's kind of serial predictions is that progressives will hit the streets in a revolutionary manner, that progressives are waiting to evolve, and that would mean liberals, social democrats, Democratic Party people, Greens, gays, the usual, that progressives are in the next 6 months going to transform into revolutionaries. Now we're going to have a kind of, you know, a social war on the streets, martial law, 16-year-olds rounding people up, and so on. So taking the left as a sort of an incipient threat to our way of life and to our civilization. And, you know, on the left, I don't know how seriously people take this stuff. It's a bit of a joke, you know? And it is a bit of a joke, except that what the left mourns, the achievements of social movements are real. There has been a massive redistribution of power in society in the 20th century. You know, the relative success of women in the economy, the relative role played by women in the economy, you know, has transformed completely in the last generation. And we're not going back. It's highly unlikely that women are going to return to a point that they were at in the 1960s or the 1970s. I mean, we don't have equality in income or anything like it, but it's highly unlikely in this society that those gains will be reversed. And so the right mourns that. That's a redistribution of power. That's a privilege that's been eroded, according to the right. And the same thing goes for civil rights. The same thing goes for this battle over gay marriage. It's an abstract, it's a wedge issue. Who really cares? From our perspective, it's not that important. But from the perspective of the right, it's real. It might be a perceived loss of privilege, but it's a loss of privilege nevertheless. So, you know, there's a sort of a tendency on the left, I think, not to claim the victories. And maybe that blinds us a little bit to what's the genuine appeal of some of this sort of right-wing catastrophist platform. So that's disease catastrophe. On the one hand, it's the mourning for the political losses that have come through the victories of previously subjugated groups. And the second category I describe is what I call cure catastrophism. And this is the idea that these advances of the left can be reversed or slowed down or interrupted or halted through some kind of sort of catastrophic conflagration. And that might be civil war or race war, or it could be, you know, anecdotally, if you take Anders Breivik, the Norwegian mass murderer who attacked, and Breivik contains many of these kind of tendencies or currents or historical traditions that I'm describing. You know, he went after the government buildings in downtown Oslo, planted some bombs, and killed a few people, I think the finance department maybe, fiat money. And the second target was this Social Democratic Youth Camp, sort of Labour Party kids, teenagers. And he saw, so his enemy is the rise of political Islam, is the Islamization of Oslo, the loss of, you know, of Norway rather, the loss of Norwegian identity, a Christian identity, a white patriarchal identity. This is what he mourns. And he sees the agency for the destruction of this civilization as Islam via, you know, Muslim immigrants from North Africa. And he sees the kind of the political mechanism through which it's accomplished as social democracy. So like the left are bringing in Muslims because they know that they're going to vote left in elections, and because the left want to destroy Norwegian civilization. They want to destroy patriarchy. They want to destroy sort of Christian white identity. And it's all there in his compendium, as he calls it. Much of this stuff cribbed from right-wingers in America, which is pretty interesting. It's kind of like going back to some of the John Birch stuff. William Lind is a big influence on him. In fact, he has part of the text is unattributed to William Lind. You read it as if it's Breivik writing, and it's kind of bizarre to read because he's writing about this idealized 1950s suburban American lifestyle. The kid coming home from school and his mother is there, and it's not a world that, you know, has existed in Norway. If it ever existed in Norway, it hasn't existed in Norway for a long time. And ironically, it's probably more like the lifestyle lived by his Muslim neighbors rather than his white post-Christian kind of neighbors. But anyway, it's not really about Norway, of course, it's about the US. Much of the right-wing stuff that he's channeling has been developed over here. And it's interesting, a lot of the writers in Europe, I'm thinking about Melanie Griffith, Bat Yor, a lot of these people, not Melanie Griffith, I'm sorry, Melanie Phillips. Melanie Griffith's an actor. Melanie Phillips, who writes for the Daily Mail. She's pretty well known. She wrote that book, Londonistan. It's like Islamopanic, you know? And, but the audience for much of this writing is actually America. Well, that's where the books get sold most. That's like where they do best in the media stuff. Because this idea of a kind of a prostate Europe destroyed by social democracy, weakened rather, by social democracy, by trade unions, by gay rights, by all this, and now like Muslim immigration, is a projection of the American right. Like, what's wrong with Europe? How come Europe is such a sort of a failed welfarist, liberal redoubt that's in decline? So this sort of European decline thing can be tied, it joins these elements, right, of the catastrophist destructive powers of the left and Islam being the active kind of ingredients to finally vanquish an already weakened Europe. So, okay, so the cure thing, I mean, we saw it here with Oklahoma City. You know, very same thing. This idea that we can do some big intervention, some big, in this case, a big terrorist attack, and that will kick things off. The state will react in a certain way, and we'll get to this kind of cataclysm beyond which we can find a new utopia, right? So this is also a very kind of right-wing dream that, you know, there's going to be a cleansing civil war, some kind of massive event, and on the other side of that, we can re-achieve nirvana, which is basically the 19th century. But in one of the things with the book, we've done a lot of talks, and one of the things that keeps coming back around is kind of like, so what, you know? So we're describing catastrophism. What does it amount to? What's the prescription? And we don't really have a prescription, but I'll end with maybe trying to see the last 15 years in the US through the eyes of the right. Okay, so, I've been, like, this covers the period of time which I've lived in this country. And in that time, we go back, say, to the late 90s with Seattle. A few years later, you've got the anti-war stuff, which was huge. Both of those were enormous events in terms of social movements and in terms of social mobilizations and in terms of inserting a critique into the dominant logic just through the force of numbers and organization. I'm thinking of the general strike in 2006. I'm thinking of Occupy. So there's four or five mass movements that have come around basically like clockwork every two or three years, you know? So the right sees that stuff and is genuinely terrified about it. That's the material that right-wing propagandists and right-wing agitators present to their base as a reason you should be fearful and a reason that authoritarian solutions are gonna work for us. I mean, the immigration stuff is probably the strongest point we have. Lou Dobbs, for example, in around 2006, when he had a show on CNN, was talking about illegal lepers sneaking around the borderlands, infecting Americans with leprosy. And he kept returning to this. It was debunked very quickly. It was debunked. His numbers were totally bogus. The whole thing was a fantasy. But Dobbs kept returning to the same point because the point wasn't leprosy. The point was we can't defend our borders. All these illegal aliens are coming in and they are undermining our Christian white hegemonic civilization and eating it out from within. And that's the fear. So when we see large social movements, while they register to us as active and ongoing kind of moments, we don't necessarily read them as victories. We often read them as defeats, because ultimately, of course, they're defeated. We're not, you know, living in a revolutionary time. But the right don't. The right see it as this incipient, rising, internal threat to the dominant order and to sort of the hegemony. So I'll leave it there and bring on Ashley.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. I wanted to thank Eddie for inviting me to be here with all of you. This is somewhat spur of the moment presentation, so it's a bit inchoate, and I look forward to hearing your thoughts about it. So the specter of catastrophe and collapse hangs very heavily on the contemporary American imagination. Think, for instance, about the New York Times image after Hurricane Sandy, in which the Statue of Liberty is submerged under the Atlantic Ocean. We seem to face not the fire, but the flood next time. And these images are obviously something that have been circulating for quite some time. In 2004, the Brooklyn Museum held an exhibit by the painter Alexis Rockman, in which a large mural, which was called Manifest Destiny, was put up, which depicted Brooklyn as a vast floodplain and familiar landmarks like the Brooklyn Bridge submerged and transformed into a lair for marine animals and plants. And Rockman did a whole series of other paintings of Washington Square Park, for instance, and the Hollywood Hills, all underground, so underwater. So this sort of sense of catastrophe is widespread. And as folks have mentioned, we also seem to be consistently confronted by fears of zombie apocalypse. And what I want to argue is that there's a kind of underlying economic rationale for some of this, and it's useful to think about ideas of risk in order to get at where this cultural politics of catastrophe and collapse is coming from. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about insurance institutions and financial markets and the ways in which catastrophic risk emerged in the 1980s. In the late 1980s, in these kind of interconnected discursive realms of environmental politics, insurance institutions, and financial markets, catastrophic risk came to designate a technological accident of biospheric proportions operating simultaneously at the microscopic and pandemic levels. From emerging biomedical and transgenic epidemics to global warming, ozone depletion, and complex humanitarian disasters, the concept of catastrophic risk introduced a fundamentally new calculus of the accident in this period. Unlike the punctual accidents of classical risk theory, that is, catastrophic risks were represented as so unpredictable and so vast in scale that they could not be insured against. According to the theorist of risk, Francois Ewald, catastrophic risks confront us with a danger, quote, we can apprehend without being able to assess, close quote. Our effective response to such insecurity therefore becomes our primary guide to a turbulent future that threatens the ecological conditions of life on Earth. In other words, you know, if we can't use any kind of metric to calculate risk, what we're left with is a sort of sense of effective panic, essentially, as the way in which we imagine the future. So in order to mount a kind of effective critique of catastrophism, I think we need to piece together the genealogy of discourses of catastrophic risk. Key in this regard, I want to argue, is an understanding of the imbrication of neoliberal theories of economic development with biotechnological visions of growth. As Melinda Cooper explains in her enormously useful book, Life as Surplus, the biotech revolution that unfolded in the US after the economic crisis of the 1970s was a product of concerted policies, quote, to relocate economic production at the genetic, microbial, and cellular level, so that life becomes literally annexed within capitalist processes of accumulation, close quote. Following the monetarist counter-revolution of 1979 to 1982, that is, U.S. interest rate policies channel global financial flows into the dollar and U.S. markets, establishing the conditions for American debt imperialism. U.S. venture capital, which was bloated with these massive inflows, turned to investment in the burgeoning biotechnology sector, where legal reforms such as the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980, which facilitated the patenting of life forms and transformed the U.S. educational apparatus. These kinds of legal reforms set the ground for the commercialization of public research and the commodification of the generative principles of life itself. Yet the life sciences were increasingly annexed to the speculative logic of, yet if the life sciences were increasingly annexed to the speculative logic of financial capital, economic discourse was conversely influenced by scientific theories of life's turbulent evolution. So there's a kind of exchange going on here. At the Santa Fe Institute, a pivotal venue for the articulation of neoliberal economic theory, conferences such as 1987's The Economy as an Evolving Complex System drew on novel insights in evolutionary biology to argue that the economic realm, like the natural world, is characterized by the evolution of complex self-regulating systems which develop according to chaotic processes of growth punctuated by periodic bouts of crisis. Building on the work of economists like Joseph Schumpeter, whose notion of creative destruction drew on evolutionary theory as well as Marxism, the neoliberal economists who hobnobbed with evolutionary theorists at the Santa Fe Institute crafted the precepts of the disaster capitalism, which have become all too familiar over the last two decades. Unlike the contemporaneous work of Ulrich Beck, who argues that the spread of risk is likely to generate new forms of cosmopolitan solidarity, Santa Fe theorists imagine catastrophic risk as a novel site for neoliberal speculation and accumulation. In tandem with these developments in the realm of economics and biotechnology, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the onset of globalization catalyzed a revolution in the immunological imaginary. After a half century during which Western nation states effectively used practices of quarantine and immunization to obliterate many diseases from the developed world, neoliberal capitalism decisively weakened nation state borders, rendering the practices of the quarantine state increasingly ineffective. As Priscilla Wald documents in her book Contagious, these trends have prompted a resurgence of the militarized language of classical germ theory, complete with spectacular articulations of imperial paranoia. Think, for instance, of Laurie Garrett's 1995 book, The Coming Plague, which tries to theorize in very scary terms various forms of plague spreading globally, all the way to a more popular cultural articulation of this kind of imperial immunological paranoia, such as Wolfgang Petersen's film Outbreak from the same year, 1995, in which a careless intrusion by Westerners into what is represented in the film as a kind of isolated prehistoric ecosystem, the tropical African jungle, in the case of other contemporary writers, the sort of intrusion into teeming cities of the global south like Lagos. Think about Robert Kaplan's work in the early 2000s, for instance. These kinds of intrusions into spaces of the non-West, of the non-developed world, are depicted as leading to epidemic explosions that contaminate the homeland. So the Coming Anarchy, Kaplan's book, is very much this sort of blending fears of immunological contagion with political collapse emerging from spaces such as global cities of Africa and the Middle East. The consolidation of global networks of human and material mobility in the neoliberal age and the resulting penetration of hitherto isolated places such as post-colonial Africa are represented as the conditions responsible for the spread of deadly microbes that threaten to obliterate the biopolitical structures of modernity. I want to be clear, I'm not saying that these places were actually isolated. This is part of the, of course, you know, sophism of these films and other things, right? The idea that in Outbreak, for instance, that Africa was an isolated space completely elides the Cold War history of American intervention into Africa. But this is a convenient fiction for the immunological imaginary. Since the microbes responsible for epidemics are themselves complex, evolving life forms that reach us through complex systems of global commerce, we cannot accurately predict the emergence of these catastrophic risks, and that's where this kind of fear comes from. Precisely because of this element of uncertainty, global environmental risk is increasingly subject to securitization of various forms, and Eddie talked a little bit about the ways in which military security is invoked, and Christian Parenti's book, which he referred to, has a lot of interesting detail about war games, which the Pentagon is running to try and deal with global environmental risk. Since the mid-1990s, new instruments, taking another sort of definition of securitization, new instruments in the financial realm, such as catastrophe bonds and environmental derivatives, have been invented that offer investors the capacity to speculate on and profit from ecological risk and catastrophe. Derivatives allow investors to, of course, hedge against the occurrence of unpredictable adverse events, such as exchange rate fluctuations, political turmoil, or in the case of environmental derivatives, extreme weather. Since these contracts can also be traded in financial markets, they're simultaneously instruments for financial wagers, and so they merge the actuarial and the speculative. These financial instruments thus invent new forms of property right that capture the speculative and catastrophic biological future before it has emerged. Yet, as those of you who followed the vicissitudes of speculative capital over the last 4 years know, and of course we all have, we've lived those vicissitudes, derivatives such as collateralized debt obligations bundle together sweeping networks of fluidly interlinked futures at purposely baroque, and in many cases opaque levels of abstraction. This collocation allows relatively small wagers to gain an extraordinary degree of leverage, right? That's why these things are useful for financial speculators. But, and here's the rub, conversely, relatively small, localized, and seemingly punctual events, like a small spate of foreclosures, can reverberate across entire interconnected networks of qualitatively disparate assets, instruments, and markets, threatening also to implode a whole ecosystem. The securitization of the environment seeking to... Okay, great, thanks. The securitization of the environment seeking to profit from biohazards of various forms thus also introduces unpredictable forms of turbulence into the networked world of finance, economics, and ecology. Turbulence like you see in a plume coming off a cigarette. Chaotic forms like the spiral of air generated by a jet engine, and of course turbulence like the massive vortex of Hurricane Sandy as it approached the eastern seaboard of the US. I'm sure you can all picture that huge sort of turbulent form, which we saw in satellite images. To ask how we can counter this kind of turbulence is to ask how we might resist a political economy that turns the environmental crisis into a tradable catastrophic risk. And I think that's what we really need to do in various different ways. As Eddie mentioned, there's a really vibrant movement around climate justice, which takes resistance to things such as RED, which tries to commodify forest forms, as one of its primary modes of mobilization. And so I think we need to look very carefully at how these kinds of speculative forms are a form of destruction of the planet rather than something that's going to save us, a form of greenwashing rather than a viable way of creating a solidaristic future for us. Thank you very much.